From New York, this is Democracy Now!
My question to you, are mobs shouting from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, or long live the infantata? Are those anti-Semitic comments?
When I hear those terms, I find them very upsetting.
The president of Columbia University is grilled at a congressional hearing about anti-Semitism on campus and what critics call the silencing of pro-Palestinian voices. We'll be joined by two Barnard Columbia professors. One of them signed an open letter from Jewish professors calling the hearings a new McCarthyism. But first, the University of Southern California cancels the commencement address of its valedictorian for what it claimed were safety reasons after she became the subject of an online anti-Palestinian hate campaign.
I was contacted by the administration on Monday, actually, this past Monday, shortly before the statement was released, that I would unfortunately no longer be allowed to give the commencement address for the class of 2024.
We'll speak with Asna Tabassum. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli forces have killed at least 11 people, including five children, in strikes on the southern city of Rafah. Israel's repeatedly attacked the city ahead of an expected ground invasion. There are new reports the Biden administration has approved Israel's plan to attack Rafah in exchange for Israel not launching counterstrikes on Iran. A 13-year-old Palestinian boy who survived an Israeli airstrike on his home in November has now died after being hit in the head with a package that was being dropped from the sky. Zain Orak died Sunday. The airstrike in November had killed 17 members of his extended family. This is Zain's grandfather, Ali Orak.
The first time when the house was hit by a strike, he came out from under the rubble with wounds in his head, hand, and leg. God saved him. Then, like the rest of the youth and children, because of hunger and frustration, he went to get a meal, a can of fava beans, a kilogram of rice or flour. The worst catastrophe is the one that makes you laugh. They kill my family and send meals for those who are left. And the one who followed the meal died as a child.
ProPublica has revealed a special State Department panel has urged the Biden administration to disqualify multiple Israeli military and police units from receiving U.S. aid over serious human rights abuses, including rape and torture. Secretary of State Antony Blinken received the recommendation in December, but has not taken any action. Meanwhile, the UN refugee agency UNRWA has accused Israeli security forces of torturing imprisoned UN workers in an effort to extract false confessions about the agency's ties to Hamas. The accusations are part of a new UNRWA report that documents how Palestinians detained in Israel have been attacked by dogs, deprived of food, forced into cages, beaten with metal bars, and tortured with nail guns and electric batons. One Palestinian child released from Israeli prison had dog bite wounds on their body. In Brussels, a speech by European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen was interrupted when a member of the audience attempted to make a citizen's arrest.
Mrs. von der Leyen, this is a citizen's arrest. You are charged with aiding genocide in Gaza. You expressed total support for Israel at the beginning of this genocide. The blood of Palestinian children is on your hands. You are a criminal, Mrs. von der Leyen. You should be in The Hague. You should not be here. You should not be running for a second term. You are a criminal. Free Palestine! Free Palestine!
The person speaking was David Cronin, an editor at the Electronic Intifada news site. He laid out his arguments against Ursula von der Leyen in a piece on the website, which details ongoing efforts to support Israel, even as evidence of genocide and war crimes pile up. Google has fired 28 workers who protested its $1.2 billion contract with Israel. Project Nimbus provides computing services to the Israeli military. This comes after peaceful sit-ins this week by Google workers at their New York City and Sunnyvale, California offices, which resulted in 9 arrests. Kate Sim, a child safety policy advisor and one of the terminated workers, said, quote, "Listen when employers tell you exactly who they are. McCarthyism is alive and well. Look how terrified they are of worker power," they said. Two of the Google workers who were fired, Mohamed Khatami and Ray Westrick, appeared on Democracy Now! Wednesday, hours before their dismissal. In more protest news, 29 authors and translators have withdrawn from consideration for PEN America's prestigious literary prizes to protest the organization's leadership and silencing of Palestinian voices. In a letter, the authors wrote, quote, "We refuse to be honored by an organization that acts as a cultural front for American exceptionalism. We refuse to gild the reputation of an organization that runs interference for an administration aiding and abetting genocide with our tax dollars. And we refuse to take part in celebrations that will serve to overshadow Penn's complicity in normalizing genocide," they wrote. On Capitol Hill, activists disrupted Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin as he spoke at a House Armed Services Committee hearing on Wednesday. Among the protesters was Nasiba Hajjaj, a Palestinian-American woman who's lost some 20 relatives in Gaza since October 7th. She held up her 16-month-old son, Hamza, during the hearing.
My child is here.
Chair notes the service of the committee.
Stop killing Palestinian children.
House Speaker Mike Johnson has released the text of 3 bills to provide $95 billion to Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan. A vote could come on Saturday. Johnson's speakership may also be on the line as 2 Republican lawmakers have backed his ouster in part over his support for sending money to Ukraine. In other news from Capitol Hill, the Democratic-controlled Senate has dismissed impeachment charges against Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. This ends a Republican effort to remove him from office. Record rainfall soaked large parts of Oman and the United Arab Emirates this week, killing at least 19 people and submerging major cities. Some areas received a year's worth of rain in just a day. Though heavy rains are expected this time of year, scientists say they're becoming more intense and more deadly because of climate change. Meanwhile, major flooding in Kenya has killed dozens of people and displaced thousands of others. French police forcibly evicted some 450 people, mostly migrants and asylum seekers, from France's largest squat located in a Parisian suburb. Housing and immigrant rights advocates say it's part of a plan to remove unhoused people and refugees from Paris ahead of the Summer Olympics. Buses were waiting to bring residents of the squat to other cities, even though many of them have jobs in the Paris area, and some families have children attending local schools. And on Capitol Hill, 2 Boeing whistleblowers did not hold back as they described to a Senate panel the chaotic manufacturing and dysfunctional safety culture at Boeing. Sam Salapour, a quality engineer at Boeing, detailed the suppression and threats faced by employees who try to warn Boeing about its planes.
I want to make clear that I have raised these issues over 3 years. I was ignored. I was told not to create delays. I was told, frankly, to shut up. At one point, Boeing management got sick of me and raising these issues and moved me out of the 787 program into this 777 program.
But Salapour says the Boeing 777 program he was reassigned to also had serious issues.
I literally saw people jumping on the pieces of the airplane to get them to align. I call it the Tarzan effect, among other improper methods. Again, I raised concerns internally. I was sidelined. I was told to shut up. I received physical threats.
Ed Pearson, a former manager at Boeing, also told lawmakers both Boeing leadership and federal regulators failed for years to heed internal warnings, even after the Lion Airlines and Ethiopia Airlines crashes in 2018 and 19 that killed all 346 people on board. This is Ed Pearson.
The world is shocked to learn about Boeing's current production quality issues. I'm not surprised because nothing changed after the 2 crashes. There was no accountability. Not a single person from Boeing went to jail. Hundreds of people died, and there's been no justice. Unless action is taken and leaders are held accountable, every person stepping aboard a Boeing airplane is at risk.
Ed Pearson also called out the investigation into January's Alaska Airlines door blowout, revealing Boeing deliberately withheld data related to work on the aircraft. Pearson told lawmakers, quote, "I'm not going to sugarcoat this. This is a criminal cover-up," he said. To see our interview with Ed Pearson, go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. Today, we'll look at the repression of pro-Palestinian voices on campuses across the United States. In a moment, we'll look at Wednesday's congressional hearings, where the president of Columbia University was grilled for hours about accusations of anti-Semitism on campus. But we begin with the University of Southern California, which continues to be rocked by controversy after canceling the commencement speech of its valedictorian for what it claimed were safety reasons after she became the subject of an online anti-Palestinian hate campaign.
Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez and I interviewed Asna Tabassum, who is a first-generation South Asian American Muslim, on Wednesday. I began by welcoming her to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So why don't you give us the chronology of what happened? I mean, to be the valedictorian of this elite university, the University of Southern California, is such an enormous achievement. Can you talk about when you learned you'd become the valedictorian and when you learned you would be giving the speech at graduation and what happened next?
Absolutely. So part of the selection process of becoming valedictorian is the willingness to give a speech during commencement. And so when I got the call, I believe in the second week of March or so, it was during Ramadan, and I was incredibly happy to receive the honor and incredibly grateful. And that was the moment I also knew that I would have the chance and the opportunity to address my peers during commencement.
And when did you hear that the university had changed its mind, and who contacted you?
Of course. So I was contacted by the administration on Monday, actually, this past Monday, shortly before the statement was released, that I would unfortunately no longer be allowed to give the commencement address for the class of 2024.
How typical is that, Asna? Does the valedictorian always give the speech?
Yes, as far as I know in history of USC, and in fact, I asked the provost this himself, has this ever happened to a USC valedictorian? And in fact, I think we both agreed that to the best of our knowledge, it has never happened before.
And what exactly did he say when he explained to you it was for safety reasons? Did he talk to you about what the threats are?
So that's exactly the question here, is that I received no details as to what the security threats or what the security concerns were. You know, I heard that there were hundreds and thousands of emails sent to the university, but I was given no clue as to what the contents of these emails were, as well as, for example, the university had said that there were other security concerns in relation to having a big event such as commencement. But, you know, even details there were unclear. And so when I had asked for details regarding the security concerns, for example, were they security concerns about me or my classmates, I was offered no information and was told it was not appropriate for me to know.
Now, were you aware that pro-Israel student groups were targeting you on social media, that a group called We Are Tav posted a photo of you on its Instagram account and claimed that you were, quote, openly, that you openly promote anti-Semitic writings?
It's honestly heartbreaking, yes. Once I was announced on social media through USC student media, it only took a few hours before such posts began circulating. And it launched a very generalized and honestly very hateful and disappointing campaign to remove me as valedictorian, yes.
I want to go to the issue that wasn't raised by the provost, but in your Instagram bio, You link to a pro-Palestine landing page that reads in part, "Learn about what's happening in Palestine and how to help." Some students took to social media to express their opposition to it due to the language on the landing page. The website states, quote, "Zionism is a racist settler colonial ideology that advocates for a Jewish ethno-state built on Palestinian land." The website also states, quote, "One Palestinian state would mean Palestinian liberation and the complete abolishment of the state of Israel," end quote. Can you talk about that and talk about when you linked to that page and your feelings about this?
Sure. So there are a few points that I'd like to clarify. The first is that a university and students have the responsibility to engage in productive and meaningful discussion. And we're allowed to learn from one another's ideas and express those ideas so that we can all grow. And I think that that's the beauty of an academic institution. But another factor that I'd like to bring up is that there are other pieces of information in that link. You know, there are paragraphs and information relating to the two-state solution as well as the one state. The sentence right after the one you just quoted talks about coexistence between Arabs and Jews. You know, there's a lot of factors here, and my goal in putting the link in my bio is simply to inform my fellow peers in the small ways that I can. But ultimately, what I want people to take away is for people to inform themselves, come to their own conclusions, and then advocate for what they believe in. And so in no way am I advocating for hate. I'm only advocating for human equality and for the sanctity of human life when I say that Palestinians, as well as Jews, as well as Muslims and Armenians and anyone else who is invested in this conflict has the equal right to life and the equal privilege of the fullest extent to life.
Well, could you tell us more about yourself? You're majoring in biomedical engineering and minoring in resistance to genocide. What inspired you to follow these courses of study?
This is my favorite question, especially because, you know, as you might know, I've been doing a lot of interviews recently, and I wish people more talked about my biomedical engineering major as well, because I think it's an important part of who I am and my worldview. That being said, the way that I see my major and my minor working together for the very same goal is that, you know, my minor in resistance to genocide allows me to study the human condition at possibly one of its worst conditions. And then biomedical engineering is my way of learning technically how we can improve the human condition through increasing health accessibility. And so the ways that I specifically see this are, for example, when I learn about the Rwandan genocide or the Holocaust or various other forms of genocides and conflicts through my minor, I look at the ways in which healthcare and health are impeded and the ways in which the quality of life are impeded so that I can build devices and health technologies using my major and using the education and the information I learned in my major of biomedical engineering to see how we can develop low cost and accessible point of care devices so that we can improve the ways in which people experience healthcare when they are at their most in need of healthcare.
Can you talk about if you were giving the speech? I mean, this speech would be given in May, right, at graduation. So isn't there still a possibility that USC could change their mind? What would your speech be? What would you say to the USC community?
So, you know, I actually have not considered and actually started writing my speech. But of course, this experience is informing me how I want to go about it. But ultimately, my message is one of hope. I think something that I truly believe in, given my familial background and, you know, the way I was raised, is that education is such a privilege. And using the ways that we have learned how to learn, it's incumbent upon us to look at the world and see what we see, and then take information and make conclusions so that we can change the world in the ways that we want to. And so In accordance with my message of hope, I also want to do a message of inspiration so that our graduates and my peers can feel empowered to take on issues of world concern and see themselves in positions of making change.
You've talked about an online hate campaign against you. Can you describe more what you have received?
Sure. I've received incredibly disappointing comments. And I think it's an unfortunate part of, expressing who you are and expressing what you believe in. But I do want to call attention to the overwhelming support. And I think that anybody who is watching this unfold is seeing that various communities, from Muslim communities to Jewish communities to South Asian and first generation American communities, all coming together to see this as something bigger and as something representative of a collective voice. And so, while there is hatred out there, I do want to give my kudos to the people who have been seeing the inspiration and seeing the hope as this unfolds.
University of Southern California valedictorian Asna Tabassum. She joined us Wednesday on Democracy Now! After USC canceled her commencement speech for what it claims are safety reasons, after Asna became the subject of an online hate campaign. Coming up, Columbia University president is grilled at a congressional hearing about anti-Semitism on campus and what critics are calling the silencing of pro-Palestinian voices. We'll be joined by two Barnard Columbia professors. One of them signed an open letter from Jewish professors calling the hearings a new McCarthyism. We'll also hear from students who've camped out on Columbia's lawn. Stay with us.
My name's Joe McCarthy, I'm the leader of the band. I don't play in the concert hall, but on the witness stand. I have the finest orchestra in Washington, D.C. And night and day, I love to play McCarthy Symphony. Well, Jenner howls and Veldy yowls and Munt says pour it on. The drums go bang, the cymbals clang from Maine to Oregon. And Hickenlooper tools the flute as victims take the stand. The finest music in the land is Joe McCarthy's band. Toodly-doo.
Toodly-doo.
Try to sue.
Try to sue.
Toodly-doo.
Toodly-doo.
Just try to sue.
Just try to sue.
But toodly-doo.
Toodly-doo.
I'll tell you more. But I'll never say it off the Senate floor. When I started chasing communists, I claimed 205. And then I said 'twas 81 to keep the thing alive. Then 57 varieties of reds and pinks galore. They're climbing on the ceiling and they're creeping on the floor. Toodly-doo.
Toodly-doo.
Try to sue.
Try to sue.
Toodly-doo.
Toodly-doo.
Just try to sue.
Joe McCarthy's Band by Joe Glazer. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
The president of Columbia University was grilled at a congressional hearing Wednesday about allegations of anti-Semitism on campus. In nearly 4 hours of grueling testimony before the Republican-led Committee on Education and the Workforce, Minouche Shafik said she'd taken serious action against the accusations, including dismissing or removing 5 faculty members from the classroom in recent months for comments related to Israel's assault on Gaza, as well as suspending 15 students and 2 student groups, Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace. Shafik's visit to Capitol Hill came after a December hearing that led to the resignations of the presidents of Harvard University and the University of Pennsylvania.
In the run-up to the congressional hearing, a group of Jewish faculty at Columbia and Barnard penned an open letter addressed to President Shafik, expressing their concerns about, quote, the false narratives that frame these proceedings to entrap witnesses and labeling the hearings a, quote, new McCarthyism. During yesterday's testimony, Lisa McClain, the Republican congressmember from Michigan, questioned Shafik over a number of pro-Palestinian slogans, including From the River to the Sea.
My question to you, are mobs shouting From the River to the Sea, Palestine will be free, or long live the infantata, are those anti-Semitic comments?
When I hear those terms, I find them very upsetting. And I have heard...
That's a great answer to a question I didn't ask, so let me repeat the question. When mobs or people are shouting, "From the river to the sea, Palestine must be free," or "Long live the Intifada," are those anti-Semitic statements? Yes or no? It's not how you feel, it's...
I hear them as such, some people don't. We have sent message...
So is that yes?
We have sent a clear message to our community.
I'm not asking about the message. Yeah. Is that fall under definition of anti-Semitic behavior? Yes or no? Why is it so tough?
Because it's a difficult issue because
I realize it's a difficult issue, but here's the problem. When people can't answer a simple question and they have a definition, but then they can't, well, I'm not really sure if that qualifies.
So
I'm asking a simple question. Maybe I should ask your task force. Does that qualify as anti-Semitic behavior, those statements? Yes or no? Yes. Okay.
Later in the hearing, Republican Georgia Congressmember Rick Allen brought up the Bible in his questioning of Shafiq. He cited the Old and New Testament and asked Shafiq if wanted Columbia University to be cursed by God.
Are you familiar with Genesis 12:3?
Probably not as well as you are, Congressman.
Well, it's pretty clear. It was a covenant that God made with Abraham. And that covenant was real clear. If you bless Israel, I will bless you. If you curse Israel, I will curse you. And then in the New Testament, it was confirmed that all nations would be blessed through you. So you do not know about that.
I have heard that. Now that you've explained it, yes,
so
I have heard that
it's
before.
It's now familiar. Do you consider that a serious issue? I mean, do you want Columbia University to be cursed by God of the Bible?
Definitely not.
Okay. Well, that's good.
Much of the questioning on Wednesday focused on Columbia's handling of faculty. New York Republican Congressmember Elise Stefanik led the charge. She grilled the president about her testimony on both the protests at Columbia and about Professor Joseph Massad, a professor of modern Arab politics who chairs an academic review committee.
And Dr. Shafiq, you realize that at some of these events, the slurs and the chants have been F the Jews, death to Jews,
yep.
F Israel, no safe place, death to the Zionist state, Jews out. You don't think those are anti-Jewish?
Completely anti-Jewish, completely unacceptable.
So you changed your testimony
horrible.
On that issue as well? So there have been anti-Jewish protests.
I didn't get to finish my sentence. So what I was going to say was there were protests that were called that were...
That's not what you were asked. You were asked, were there any anti-Jewish protests? And you said no.
So the protest was not labeled as an anti-Jewish protest.
I'm not asking what it was labeled.
Anti-Israeli government policy.
The question wasn't what it was labeled.
But anti-Semitic incidents happen, or anti-Semitic things were said. So I just
wanted to finish. It is an anti-Jewish protest. You agree with that? You change your testimony?
Congresswoman, anti-Jewish things were said at protests, yes.
Thank you for changing your testimony. Another instance when you changed your testimony is you stated that Professor Massad was no longer chair. Then you stated he's under investigation. He is still chair on the website. So has he been terminated as chair?
Congresswoman, I want to confirm the facts before getting back to you.
I know you confirmed that he was under investigation.
Yes, I can confirm that.
Did you confirm he was still the chair?
I need to confirm that with you.
Well, let me ask you this. Will you make the commitment to remove him as chair?
I think that would be, I would, yes.
In a statement emailed to Democracy Now!, Professor Joseph Massad said Republicans had, quote, fabricated statements about him and that it was, quote, news to him that he was under investigation. He said no one had spoken to him about his chairmanship of the committee in question. For more, we're joined by two guests. Nara Milanic is a professor of history at Barnard College, part of Columbia University, who co-wrote an open letter to President Shafiq titled "Jewish Faculty Reject the Weaponization of Antisemitism." Professor Milanic is a member of the American Association of University Professors, or AAUP. And Professor Rebecca Jordan-Young is also with us, professor in the Department of Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at Barnard College at Columbia. She's a member of the Columbia chapter of the American Association of University Professors. She's also a member of the faculty and staff for Justice in Palestine. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Professor Rebecca Jordan-Young, let's begin with you. Your response to these hearings yesterday.
My response is, first, let me just thank you for the opportunity to talk with you. It's so important. My first response is that what happened at those hearings yesterday should be of grave concern to everybody, regardless of their feelings on Palestine, regardless of their politics. What happened yesterday was a demonstration of the growing and intensifying attack on liberal education writ large. So there was an opportunity yesterday for President Shafik to come forward to mount a robust defense of the university as a unique site for a debate of difficult ideas, for the fact that slogans can't be reduced to sound bites, that in fact that what happens at the university is deep discussion, deep thought, and that in fact instead what we got was a live performance of her not just throwing protesters and specific professors under the bus, which we somewhat anticipated, as awful as that was, but in fact throwing the entire university system under the bus, throwing out established policies and procedures of the university, throwing out rules that have been established by the American Association of University Professors for decades as best practices, actually announcing unilateral decisions on faculty members on live television, which she doesn't actually have the authority under the university to do. And I could say more, but really I was astonished. It went worse even than any of us had expected.
So, Professor Nara Milanish, if you could also respond, what most struck you about the hearing and what Professor Young just said, that the debate, rather than it being a debate about difficult questions, it became extremely narrow. And Columbia President Shafik seemed to capitulate almost entirely, as Professor Young said, through the entire university apparatus under the bus. If you could respond to that, what was your sense?
So my sense, one of the things that I learned is that congressional hearings are kind of like social media, which is to say they are wonderful places for political performance, for political theater, for sound bites, for gotcha moments, for interrupting one another. They are really terrible spaces to have deep debates about serious and contentious issues. And academic freedom is one of those issues. What goes on campus is, and what is happening on campus right now is one of those issues. Where my freedom to speak ends and your right to be free of harassment begins, those are really difficult questions. And a congressional hearing, Twitter, are not the places to be litigating these issues. The place to be talking about these issues is on college campuses, in classrooms, in university quads, in dorm room hallways, right? Universities are precisely the place where we should be having these deep and difficult conversations. And instead, we have seen time and again that university administrators are ceding this conversation to people who have very different motives, right? And who are engaging on these issues for very, very different reasons.
And if you could talk, Professor Young, about the establishment of this congressional committee to begin with and what we saw happening in December, which led to the resignation of two of the presidents of the top universities in the U.S.
Well, I think it's been clear from the very beginning that this task force, that this committee was actually never about anti-Semitism. This was about a broad attack on liberal education. And, you know, we have many people on this committee who've never before expressed any concern about anti-Semitism. And what we saw was that anti-Semitism, or the a particular interpretation of that, a very precise, very politically aligned interpretation of that, has been procedurally split off from discussion about all other forms of harassment, discrimination, violence, etc. And this is really contrary to what we do in the university. Certainly, it's contrary to what we do in my field, where broadly, this has been created and used as an opportunity to attack all forms of liberatory critical scholarship. It's been a place where critical race studies have gotten attacked. It's attacking DEI. And throughout, unfortunately, the university presidents who've been questioned, and yesterday President Shafiq among them and the rest of the members of the Columbia leadership, played along with this willingness to split these groups apart. But it's absolutely against what we do both in scholarship and justice activism. We try to help students understand the intertwined nature of systems of power and oppression and discrimination.
So if you could say, in the past, how has Columbia University, in other instances of harassment for other reasons, how has Columbia University dealt with those complaints of harassment, persecution, etc., by students or by faculty?
Well, there are disciplinary procedures in place and have been for a very long time, and they involve members from all sectors of the university that both develop the policies and who are involved in adjudication of particular complaints. What we've seen happening in the run-up to this particular hearing is it looked like the university was doubling down or tripling down on just how much surveillance and policing they could demonstrate ahead of time to say, look, we are a surveillance campus. We're a law and order campus. There won't be protest on the university campus. Columbia has historically been a center of protest and free speech, which is essential for our role as preparing students to be active members of a democracy. And instead, what's happening now is an arrogation of the right to decide all of those procedures just at the level of the administration, to actually treat protest itself as dangerous and as violent, which is really, really bone-chilling to me. The other thing that they've done is actually outsource a lot of the investigations and the hearings, especially that our students have been subjected to law firms and private investigation firms that are not in any way aligned with understanding the mission and the history of the university as a site for deep and principled disagreements.
I wanted to go to Democratic Congressmember Ilhan Omar, one of only two Muslim Congress members questioning Columbia President Shafiq.
Have you seen anti-Muslim protests on campus?
I have seen. We have had pro-Israeli demonstrations on campus?
No.
But
just
not,
a protest that was
not,
against Muslims?
No, I have not.
Have you
not
seen one against Arabs?
No, I have not.
Have you seen one against Palestinians?
No, I have not.
Have you seen against Jewish people? Have you seen a protest saying we are against Jewish people?
No, I have seen.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. There has been a rise in targeting and harassment against anti-war protesters, because it's been pro-war and anti-war protesters is what it seems like, correct?
Correct. There has
been.
Okay,
thank you.
So that's Congressmember Ilhan Omar, one of two congresswomen, Muslim congresswomen in the House. In January, Congressmember Omar, also in this hearing, brought up the attack on pro-Palestinian students in January, who say they were sprayed with a foul-smelling chemical. Eight students were reportedly hospitalized, complaining of burning eyes, headaches and nausea and other symptoms. Organizers allege the attack was carried out by two Columbia students who are former members of the Israeli military, using a chemical weapon known as skunk that the Israeli military and security forces regularly deploy against Palestinians. Professor Young, if you can comment on that incident of what happened and what happened to these students.
Yes, absolutely. First, I'll just say that in the 1980s, when I was an undergraduate, I was an organizer against, and I was an anti-apartheid organizer, and I was involved in a lot of demonstrations on my campus. My colleague students all around the country were faced with a lot of condescending policies and a lot of pressures from administrations and crackdowns. Never, ever have I seen something like what happened on the Columbia campus. Never, first of all, have I seen a situation where the administration sets up students to say that protests themselves are problematic. You can't be against a war. You can't be against indiscriminate bombing of civilians. I mean, what's getting lost in this is the situation in Gaza. And at the same time, what we saw is that the university did not respond to that attack on our students. Students were never contacted. The students who were actually attacked with that chemical weapon were not supported until after the fact, after intense pressure from faculty. The administration said that they would offer them some resources, but they also said that students who were subject to this skunk attack would not be exempt from the sanctions imposed on them for protesting. And I also think it's important to say that these policies against protest are not longstanding policies. They're new policies that have been created on the fly, sometimes after the fact of particular demonstrations. And the inquiry hearings that are being held are getting more and more draconian, so that there's a dragnet, basically, of sweeping up all kinds of students that they target, often because of wearing hijab, often because of being near other students, being friends with students who are protesting. So it's sweep everybody up, ask questions later. And it's, again, it's so chilling to me.
And Professor Milanesh, in your open letter, and the open letter that you wrote prior to this hearing to Columbia President Shafiq, you said it's absurd to claim that anti-Semitism is rampant on Columbia's campus. So why do you think that so many people are convinced that this is the case? And as Professor Young said, nothing like what's happened at Columbia has happened in the past with protests. How do you understand why this has happened?
Yeah, so I think this is a really important question. And I had the opportunity to author this open letter to President Shafiq in advance of her testimony with almost two dozen of my colleagues who identify as Jewish. And it's important to know here that Columbia has a large Jewish population of Jewish faculty and Jewish students. But there is no such thing as a Jewish opinion, right, on campus. This is a really heterogeneous group, a diverse group, people with very different experiences, different identities, and different politics, different ideas, different relationships, or even non-relationships with Israel, right? And we had the sort of impression, the sense that people were speaking for us, right? People were assuming that we needed to be protected, that we felt vulnerable, people assuming that we all shared a particular political point of view. And we wrote this letter to President Shafiq to clarify that, to explain sort of the diversity of different political opinions on campus, and to question this idea of a single hegemonic Jewish position or voice or experience. And the letter goes on to implore President Shafiq not to capitulate to this kind of politics of weaponizing anti-Semitism. One of the remarkable things that we have seen in recent months since the fall are the ways that right-wing politicians have suddenly discovered, they've had a come-to-Jesus moment, and have discovered Jews, and have discovered the scourge of anti-Semitism. And of course, many of these folks are people who flirt with white nationalism, right, in their everyday life, which is to say with actual anti-Semites, right? So we wanted to make the case, and that my colleague has made as well, that anti-Semitism here is being used as a wedge. It's being used as a Trojan horse for a very different political agenda, and that is a broader and deeper kind of desire or effort to insert politics into the university. So we can see how right-wing politicians, even yesterday on display in the congressional hearings, have a bigger agenda, a bigger axe to grind. They are interested in undermining academic freedom, in attacking wokeism. This is not about anti-Semitism so much as attacking areas of inquiry and teaching, whether it's about voting rights or vaccine safety or climate change, right? Arenas of inquiry that are uncomfortable or inconvenient or controversial for certain groups. And so this is essentially what we're seeing, anti-Semitism being weaponized in a broad attack on the university. And I think that's really worrisome. And we're all sort of looking to November to think about what happens then. I mean, if this is what is going on now, what happens if Trump is reelected? And then we get these inclinations coming not just from Congress, but also from higher up.
Well, we want to thank you both for being with us. Nara Milanich is a professor of history at Barnard Columbia. She co-wrote the open letter to President Manoush Shafiq titled Jewish Faculty Reject the Weaponization of Anti-Semitism. We also want to thank Professor Rebecca Jordan-Young in the Department of Women's, Gender and Sexuality Studies at Barnard College, Columbia, member of the faculty and staff for Justice and Palestine. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As Columbia University President Shafiq testified before Congress about accusations of anti-Semitism at the school, Democracy Now! Spoke to Columbia and Barnard College students yesterday who set up a Gaza solidarity encampment early Wednesday morning, with dozens of tents occupying the south lawn of the campus outside the main library. As we broadcast, students have been threatened with suspension and discipline action, but are still refusing to leave until their demands are met. They spoke about what they're calling for.
My name is Miriam Alwan, and I'm with Columbia SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, and we are here today to demand that Columbia divest immediately from all stakes in Israeli apartheid. Over 33,000 Palestinians have been killed, and as we speak, our president is testifying in front of the House in a game of political theater that is conflating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. We want to focus the attention on what's going on in Gaza and tell Columbia that we are not going anywhere, no matter how much government suppression we face. We will keep fighting until they divest. They have been completely repressive. I mean, we faced police brutality. We have faced countless policy changes. I mean, my group, along with Jewish Voice for Peace, was suspended in the fall semester completely illegitimately. I filed a lawsuit to counter that action. And it seems like the repression is only getting worse and worse and worse. But the more they repress us, the more we rise up, and that's why we've escalated. That's also why we've escalated here today. Not only are they not listening to us when we peacefully protest, when we attempt to just pass referendums for student voices to even be heard, they don't even want to listen to the students. They don't want to know what the students think. And so we're here to tell them that we will take up space and presence on this campus, and they're not going to be able to erase our support for Palestine.
What do we want?
Justice!
When do we want it?
Now!
If Rafa doesn't get it!
Shut it down!
My name is Soph. I am with Jewish Voice for Peace at Columbia, and I am here today because I will not stand by while thousands and thousands of people are dying because of our tax dollars in this country, as Columbia's money is going towards a genocide. The money that should be funding our education is going to the bombs that are dropping on Gaza. Right now, Columbia is a majority share. It has massive amounts of shares in various organizations like Lockheed Martin that are supplying Israel with bombs right now, and we will no longer be complicit. In a campus like this that is filled with repression, that is every day we wake up and the administration tries to silence us more and more, we are here to say the more you try to silence us, the louder we will be. We will not be complicit. We will stand in solidarity because we know that we keep us safe. We refuse to believe that Israel is in any part related to our Judaism. In fact, our Jewish values inform why we're here, why we're standing in here. Jewish values of tikkun olam, of love, of appreciation, of respect, of mutual liberation. And so as Jews, we are here to say that we will always support the liberation of Palestine, because that is what historically Jews have done. We have stood up for other oppressed peoples because we know that there can be no freedom until we are all free.
Free! Free Palestine!
Free! Free Palestine!
Free! Free! Free Palestine!
My name is Sarah Boris. I'm a student at Barnard College, and I'm here because I was raised as an anti-Zionist Jew. It is important for me to stand with Palestine. I go to a university that is actively profiting off of the genocide of Palestinians and then is hiding behind Jewish students by saying that they want to crack down on us because of anti-Semitism. But as an anti-Zionist Jew, I know that that is the farthest thing from the truth. They are doing that because they know that we are on the right side of history, that they are doing something that is profoundly wrong, and it is our job during this genocide to come out and resist. There were Jews protesting against this genocide who were harassed and then attacked with a chemical weapon that is not being addressed. This is, quite frankly, we're seeing McCarthyism once again. And our administrators need to be aware of the experience of anti-Zionist Jews, the way that anti-Semitism is being weaponized in order to crack down on this movement.
Voices from the South Lawn of Columbia University, where students have set up a Gaza solidarity encampment. Special thanks to Democracy Now!'s Hannah Elias and Tamarie Astudio and Eric Halverson for that report. When we come back, we go to Tel Aviv, Israel, to speak with a senior Israel analyst for the International Crisis Group about why Israel-Iran war is a lifeline for Prime Minister Netanyahu. Back in 20 seconds. Soti, my voice, by ML. This is Democracy Now! I'm Imi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Israeli forces have killed at least 11 people, including 5 children, in strikes on the southern city of Rafah. Israel has repeatedly attacked the city ahead of an expected ground invasion. There are new reports the Biden administration has approved Israel's plan to attack Rafah in exchange for Israel not launching counterstrikes on Iran. The latest article by our next guest is headlined, Why Israel-Iran War is a Lifeline for Netanyahu. In it, she writes, quote, just days ago, much of the world's attention was on the impending famine in Gaza and on Israel's failure to achieve its war objectives of toppling Hamas and returning hostages more than 6 months into the war. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was under pressure from U.S. President Joe Biden to allow insufficient humanitarian aid and reach a ceasefire, as well as appeals from Israeli protesters to seal a hostage deal and hold new elections. But at night, on Saturday, April 13th, all that faded instantly as Iran launched hundreds of drones and missiles at Israel in much anticipated retaliation for an Israeli strike that killed senior Iranian military officials in Damascus, Syria on April 1st.
That article is by Merev Zonshine, a senior Israel analyst for the International Crisis Group. She's joining us now from Tel Aviv. Merev, thanks so much for being with us. Can you start off by just continuing your argument? Lay out what you think has happened in the last few days.
Thanks for having me. Well, essentially, we have an ongoing war for months and months that Netanyahu has orchestrated in a way that clearly he's talking about a total victory that most Israelis now understand is he's not able to achieve. He has lost a lot of legitimacy, both at home and abroad. At the same time, many Israelis have supported the war effort. They're in trauma. And so you have this chaotic situation. And just days ago, we started to see what looked like, at least rhetorically, cracks in what has been U.S. support for Israel's war effort in Gaza. And just as things started to seem to change a little bit, primarily as a result of an absolute humanitarian disaster man-made in Gaza, all of a sudden, attention has gone elsewhere to another very worrying development with Israel and Iran. Now, I can't speak to Netanyahu's intent on the decision to strike the Damascus consular facility on April 1st. But what I can say is that when you've lost legitimacy and when former security officials and even some current ones are telling everyone that Netanyahu is not fit to lead and is not fit to be, you know, providing any kind of safety and security for Israelis, and then he takes a decision to strike a consulate, then that's clearly something that he took into account. In other words, it could have either led to nothing or it could have led to what we saw, and in which case he's now basically benefiting from the fact that all the world now has to kind of cooperate with him. The Western capitals, surely some Arab countries as well, have no choice but to kind of band together against this Iranian threat.
And Mehrav, could you explain your article before this one earlier this month is titled "The Problem Isn't Just Netanyahu, It's Israeli Society." Explain what you mean by that and what you think the problem is with people focusing only on his being the head of Israel, Netanyahu, and taking all the decisions.
Right. Well, I mean, it's important to understand some of the nuances. I mean, basically, Israeli society is largely a right-wing society. It is a society that has not spoken about or thought about Palestinians or the occupation except when it's forced to. And it is a society that has gotten used to acting with impunity. After the Hamas October 7th attack, which was truly unprecedented for Israelis, there was huge consensus for the war. And there's been almost, you know, complete apathy to what's happening in Gaza. Israelis are not really interested or emotionally capable of handling that. And there's been a dehumanization of Palestinians for a very long time. So you have this kind of consensus and just support for Israel's war effort. At the same time, you have a leader, specifically Netanyahu, but also the far-right government in general, that many liberal secular Israelis don't support. And so you have a situation in which the Western capitals in the world that have pretty much unconditionally supported Israel have found a way to try and kind of split between, you know, criticism of Netanyahu, but supporting Israeli society at large. Now, I understand why they're doing that, but it's just important to understand that even if you took Netanyahu out of the equation and you put somebody else, some of his political rivals, in the leadership positions, their approach to the Palestinian issue is almost identical. There's really no difference there. So the Israelis that are protesting Netanyahu now are not protesting him about his policies on Palestinians. They're protesting him about his attacks on their own freedoms and the fact that kind of the same human rights violations that Israel has been doing for years are now starting to seep into their own world.
Can you talk, Mehrav, about this possible trade-off that's being reported? Israel, U.S. wanting Israel not to attack Iran again, but they can invade Rafah.
I think all of this is largely theater and largely performative. I mean, basically, Israel has been dangling the threat of an invasion in Rafah for months now. It doesn't mean that I don't think it's something that it plans to do, but the U.S. pushback on it, while firm rhetorically, hasn't really been convincing. I'm not convinced that the U.S. is actually about to withhold aid or that the U.S. or Biden were actually going to stop Israel from invading Rafah because they largely support the war effort. And Israel is almost surely going to respond to the Iranian strike in some way. And it's understandable, you know, if we understand the ways Israel works, that it would do so. I think it's also understandable that Israel, you know, would now, since it hasn't already responded, it's now going to consider its options in how it can do that and how it can leverage that situation. So now, in effect, it has the benefit of being able to kind of dangle both threats. We're both going to attack Iran and we're going to attack Rafah. And so ultimately, those things are still the case.
It's, we have to leave it there. Mayrav Sunshein, senior Israel analyst for the International Crisis Group, will link to your piece in Foreign Policy. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!